I'm Christopher Lydon in Beirut with the photographer and art historian Greg Bouchakjian. His new book is called War and Other Impossible Possibilities, subtitled Thoughts on Arab History and Contemporary Art. Greg Bouchakjian, we love this intersection of art and real history, real life. In this playground of capitalism, you have a taste for absurdity and beauty. The new work on your walls is of abandoned buildings here in Lebanon, a lot of them in Beirut, I think. And yet this is mysteriously also a city full of construction cranes, new building going on, almost a new city being built downtown. Tell me about your work.
Well, before telling you about your work, I should tell you that it's been like this for 150 years. In fact, it started with the Industrial Revolution and the fact that Beirut became, at the time of the Ottoman Empire, a main port between East and West. So since this time, Beirut is growing up, and you have old buildings being demolished, new building being built. And it was always done without any urbanistic consideration. It was only based on economic consideration.
What a visitor notices is there's no plan, but there's also no sentiment either. Beautiful old buildings of the Ottoman period.
Absolutely not. There is no sentiment, there is no aesthetic, there is no consideration for beautiful buildings. Absolutely not. The only consideration is money. This must be clear. And many times, now there are some associations that are trying to fight. Sometimes they are able to prevent the demolition of a building. Sometimes they are not. Sometimes contractors demolish the building illegally without permission of the government. We have seen examples where the building was demolished at night. They bring a bulldozer and they tear down the building, and then it's too late. So it's a war. It's a war happening. It's a new war. It's an economic war. It's a real estate war. And when you know the value of land in this city, you understand that there is a lot of money which is involved.
The other mystery for me is that some buildings that are really wrecks of the war, the famous Holiday Inn overlooking the water, and many others, full of shell holes and uninhabitable, are still there 20, 30 years later.
This is fascinating because in one side you have buildings which were in an excellent condition that are demolished, and in another you have ruins that are still here. So it's an involuntary monument for the Lebanese civil war.
Describe where you're coming from. An artist with an Armenian name in Lebanon, in the shadow of war in Syria, looking at what's called the Arab upheaval.
Well, I'm coming from Beirut. My parents were born in Beirut. I'm of an Armenian origin. So I have an Armenian identity, but I am a Lebanese citizen. I was born here. I was raised here. I lived almost all my life in the city. And I have lived the Lebanese Civil War, which was a great trauma, as it was for everyone in this country for 15 years, 1975-1990. Then I studied in Paris at the Sorbonne. I came back in Lebanon in 1995. And at this time, we had what we call the Reconstruction. People were hoping or expecting to see a recovery, a fast recovery of the country, and to see prosperity come again. And of course, things didn't happen as expected. To define myself, I'm a very skeptical person. And when you ask me about revolution or Arab Spring or anything, I'm skeptical. I don't say that I'm against. Who I am, I'm just an ordinary citizen. But I am not part of the people who have these very optimistic views and that imagine that this region can be as wealthy and democratic as, let's say, Western Europe. You know, the French have an expression, le sens de l'histoire, the direction of history. This expression is mainly based on the French Revolution and the American Revolution that preceded its decades. And it means that history goes from dark ages into enlightenment, and this enlightenment will see the liberation of people. But let's talk about France in the 18th century.
Yeah, please.
France had a king, Louis XVI. Louis XVI was a very weak person. You cannot compare Louis XVI with Bashar al-Assad. Absolutely not. So this French Revolution, it was, of course, a victory and so on, but it was not a liberation war. It was not. It was mainly a combat between two social entities, which was the bourgeoisie against the aristocracy. So it was the merchants, the future industrialists, and so on, who wanted to take power over the old families who ruled the country. Personally, and this is my idea, I don't agree with the direction of history. Because, and I will say it not for the Arab world, but for the whole world. Today we are living in an era of neoliberalism, we are living in an era where the world is commanded by brokers and bankers and things like this. And I don't see this as a very optimistic view for the fulfillment of humanity. Of course, we were happy when Barack Obama was elected the first time, and we were happy when he was elected the second time, but so what? It doesn't change. It's not a matter of who is the president of the United States, who is the president of France, who is the prime minister in Germany or in the United Kingdom or in Russia or elsewhere. The fact is today the world is not going towards more enlightenment or more humanism. The world is going towards the enrichment of a category of people who are ruling over economic empires. So if the sens de l'histoire, the direction of history, is let some companies taking the place of states and empires, well, I don't, perhaps this, it should be like this, but I don't see myself in it. I don't find it a very good direction. According, of course, to my humble opinion.
Greg Buchakjian, the nightmare thread through your book is warfare in the Middle East. You begin with the Arab-Israeli War in 1948, and you go, it's a long list, in the Sudan, the Suez Crisis, the Lebanese Crisis, the Second Sudanese Civil War in the 80s and 90s, the First Palestinian Intifada. It goes on through Darfur, the Gaza War of 2008, the Libyan War, and now the Syrian uprising. What is the promise of the revolution in the Arab world to deal with the war problem?
For me, the Arab uprising is not an exception. It is in the continuation of events and wars that happened in this region since World War II. As I said previously, this region has seen much more wars than you have countries. The list of wars is impressive, and this region is doomed by wars. Today it's Syria, before it was Libya. Yemen is a country that has seen a very huge number of wars, Sudan too. Let's not talk about Iraq, and let's not talk about Palestine, because for 2 years, the Palestinian situation has been completely out of focus. And it's since Israel started their attack on Gaza that Palestine is again in the news and on the map. And we must not forget what the core of the Arab situation is a Palestinian problem. You won't have any solution in this region without a solution to the Palestinian problem, and I don't see how you can have a solution to the Palestinian problem. There have been a peace process which was a complete farce in the 1990s. It was a farce since the beginning because the Israelis didn't give anything. Mm. They didn't stop colonizations. And today, speaking about negotiations, or nobody believes in it anymore.
Does a popularly elected, still controversial president of Egypt help toward a Palestinian resolution?
There is no resolution. There is no resolution. As Ghassan Salhab said, and I approve what he said, there is no time of peace. There is no peace. You just have war, and then you have periods of relief. So when we talk about what the Egyptian president is doing for the Palestinians, or what the Emir of Qatar did also, he went to Gaza, it's just giving some breathe. It won't bring a solution. For the simple reason is that the Egyptian president, whatever are his intentions, he doesn't have the... Whatever he wants, he cannot do it. He cannot change. What are you going to do? Ask Israel to leave everything? They won't do it. They won't do it because they are stronger than you. Why do you want the stronger to surrender? It's not the stronger that surrender, it's the weak. Israel is stronger militarily and politically than its Arab neighbors. So they won't give up. And the more years pass, the less they give up. The current Israeli government doesn't want to give anything. But the previous Israeli governments, the open-minded Israeli governments, they were giving up, but very little. Rabin was assassinated. He was, of course, better than Netanyahu, but he was not giving so much. You ask me for a solution, there is no solution. Not now, not in 10 years, not in 20 years. I don't think so. Now, I'm not God. I don't know what will happen. But as I see the elements and as I see historical facts, we don't... Speaking about a peace process is a total illusion that doesn't bring us anywhere. Mm. You can speak about periods of calm and relief. Okay, yes. What they say in French, une trêve. So you stop, you don't fight. You don't fight, but it's not peace. So when we look to all this, the Arab Spring or Arab revolutions or Arab uprising or Arab whatever must be put in this perspective, which is a global perspective, which is a very complicated perspective. It's a perspective in which you have alliances that change very fast. Let's not forget that Bashar al-Assad and Qaddafi were received as very frequentable heads of states not very long time ago. Bashar al-Assad was invited in Paris at the 14th of July military parade by President Sarkozy. Qaddafi was invited by Sarkozy and by everybody. So alliances change, everything change, everything is unstable, but you have the constants. Constants is the importance of oil, the strategic importance of oil for the Western powers, but not only for the Western powers, for China also, which is now the most important industrial power, and that's a country which must secure its own oil. So you have the importance of oil, and you have the Israeli-Arab conflict that started more than half a century ago, and that is not about to end, and that will not end. So this whole Arab Spring or Arab revolutions come in a very complicated context. Mm-hmm. With a lot of... So on one side, you have a lot of popular demands. People who need wealth, we need democracy, people who are hungry. And on the other side, you have all the geopolitical interests and all the foreign interference in all these countries. And when I mean foreigns, I mean not only one foreign power, I mean a lot of foreign powers. And all this makes the situation extremely complicated, extremely unpredictable, extremely dangerous.
Can I try out a very romantic notion of the Arab Spring? To me, it's an almost abstract event in which hundreds of thousands of people came back and back and back. They're still in Tahrir Square saying, stop. Yeah. The dictatorships, the repression, the torture is a crime against all of us. The economic system is not working for but a tiny slice. And also, to keep it to three main points, the environmental system, even in Cairo, where people are choking on car fumes, is becoming extremely scary for the whole species. It's really not so much about the event in Tahrir Square, it's about who will hear it, who will hear it as a kind of universal panic button.
Well, you have universal panic buttons. You have the Arab revolutions have not been the only revolutions. They have not been the only contest, the only opposition movements. You know, last year the person of the year by Time magazine was the protester, and it was the protester from Wall Street to Moscow, from Tahrir Square to anywhere, I don't know. And you have these people who went into. You know, I remember the images on in Wall Street. You had all these demonstrators, and you had these brokers inside the buildings, looking at them, laughing, and drinking champagne. And for me, this is as shocking as what happens in Cairo or Damascus or Beirut or Yemen, because in fact it's if you look at it globally, it's the whole problem that the world is being run by an elite of money power people, of company leaders. These people are more powerful than governments, are more powerful than any government in the world. And these people are leading the world towards a very dangerous direction. Let it be economic, let it be moral, let it be social, let it be environmental. And this applies what's happening in the agriculture of Mexico, which is absolutely catastrophic. It's catastrophic in the environmental way. It's catastrophic for the people themselves. It's happening in India. It's happening in China. It's happening everywhere. So on one side, you have people trying to fight, trying to struggle for dignity, for human rights, and these people are right. But what are they able to do? What are we able to do against these people, against these huge companies, against these huge banks? I'm not going to name this famous bank who is said to rule the world. Everybody knows what bank I'm talking about. And the French-German television Arte did 2 months ago a whole program about it. It's a whole scandal. And you know what's the worst? It's that everybody knows it's a whole scandal. Today, everybody has access to internet. Everybody has access to the information to know what's happening in the financial system. It's a whole scandal. Everybody knows what's happening in the agricultural system and all these genetically modified things they are putting. They are creating pollution. They are destroying traditional agriculture. They are destroying societies in many countries, including the United States. It's a scandal. And we know all this. In the Middle Ages, perhaps you had scandals, but at least the poor guy didn't know all this. So the poor guy was was he accepted it because he said, okay, it's the fate of God. It's like this, and I try to work hard, and then I will die, and this is life. The problem is today that you just have to Google any keyword related to economy, to politics, to September 11, to agriculture, to environment, to finance, to anything. And you discover all the scandals with proofs, with documents, with sometimes reports from United Nations agencies. It's not, we are not anymore in a situation of conspiration theory, because even the conspiration theory guys are dépassé, as you say in France. You don't even have to be a conspiration theory guy to know it's a scandal. You just have to be connected to the internet. You find these scandals on Wikipedia and on mainstream media. You find it in the New York Times, in Le Monde, in The Guardian. You find it everywhere. It's not even hidden. So we were talking about the Arab world, which is one of the most violent regions in the world. So I'm not optimistic about the Arab world because I'm not optimistic about the world as a whole. We have got about 50 wars. We have the problem of oil. We have the Palestinian problems. We have dictatorships. We have all things. But globally, see the financial crisis that started 5 years ago, the world financial crisis. You have a lot of people who are still in their seats. They are still making billions, and people are starving. And even in developed countries, people are starving. How many people are sleeping in the street in Los Angeles, New York, Madrid, Barcelona, Paris, London, which are the wealthiest cities of the world? Even in Japan, I participated 2 years ago to the Nordic Photo Festival in the Netherlands, which is one of the leading photo festivals. And the theme of the festival was urban life in the modern metropolis, and one of the artists exhibiting was a Mexican photographer, and he photographed misery not in Mexico, he photographed misery in Osaka. Do you imagine a guy from Mexico, Carlos Casales, who went to Osaka to find that there is misery as well as in his own country, which is supposed to be a third world country? So you have everywhere misery. So this is how the world is running, unfortunately.
I think that's what the Arab revolt is about, in some fashion. I mean, if a million pigeons had flown down into Tahrir Square, we would have said, something's up in the pigeon world. They're worried about their species. I think it's almost that simple about human beings. I think a million people come to Tahrir Square because, as human beings, we know we're lost in a fashion.
The fact they went to Tahrir Square, the fact that they overcame the fear of being arrested or something else, you know, the Egyptian police was not very sympathetic. It's surely due to the fact that they needed to express something. They needed to express the fact that they were lost, that they didn't have. What are the perspectives of these people? What are the perspectives of most of these people? Most of the people in the Arab world are very young. It's a very young region. We have very young people. And most of these very young people who have access to the internet, who see advertising, who see TV series, and what are their perspectives? Unemployment or underemployment. You have guys in Syria who study at university, who have high degrees, and then they work in a gas station and get $200 a month. What? This is life? Do you go to university to work on a parking lot or on a gas station or something like this? What are the perspectives of these people? It's very sad to say, but You said this million or whatever person who went in on Tahrir Square, they had a cry of despair. And it's the same for the people who went down in the street in Madrid or in New York. It's not the same situation, because in Madrid and New York, they don't have a dictator. They don't have someone who will put them in jail if they enter on a prohibited website. In each country, you have its own problem. So even in the Arab world, the problems of Egypt are not the same of Iraq, and not the same of Tunisia, and not the same of Yemen. Each of these countries is a different society, which is its own problems. Of course, you have global problems, and you have the global problem, which is poverty, and you have another problem that comes over poverty, and which is a consequence of poverty, which is fanatism, religious fundamentalism. And we are talking about Islamic fundamentalism, but we must not forget that you have fundamentalism in all religions. You have Jewish fundamentalism, you have Christian fundamentalism, you have Hindu fundamentalism, you have Hindus fighting against Muslims in India, or Hindus fighting against Buddhists. You have in the whole world what I would call withdrawal of modernity, meaning that modernity are the new ideas, the secular ideas that came with the French Revolution and the Industrial Revolution, the development of bourgeois society, and so on and so on, and Marx and Engels. And today, in the whole world, we are seeing a withdrawal of modernity, a withdrawal of open-mindedness towards more fanatism and more nationalism. See what happened in the Balkans 20 years ago, the war in former Yugoslavia, how people killed each other. Now they are killing each other in Syria. But it's as if it was the same war that was 40 years ago in Vietnam, 30 years ago in Lebanon. Look how a war ends, another begins. The war of Vietnam ends in 1975-76. The war of Lebanon starts in 1975. The war of Lebanon ends in 1990. It starts in Yugoslavia. It starts in Algeria. It starts in Iraq, Kuwait, and so on. And you know when the war started in Yugoslavia, where did the arms come from? From Lebanon. Many of the weapons used in the Yugoslavian war came from Lebanon, from Lebanese militias. And then it come back to our neighbor. It's tragic. It's as if it was a dance, a dead dance, a Machiavellic dance, which is running around countries. You ignite it here, then it stops, and it starts anywhere else. But you don't have any periods without war. It doesn't exist. Why it doesn't exist? Because it's in the interest of the big superpowers. Why? Not because the American people will be wealthier if there is a war. Because in these countries you have a military-industrial lobby which is very influent and wants to sell weapons.
Greg Bouchakchian, you know the Arab world well. Can you imagine that this season of protest in Tunisia, in Egypt, terrible war in Syria, could serve as a moment for the world, a signal to the world of some terrible danger and possibly of another way?
Look, there have been many signals of terrible danger. You remember when, before the war started in between the United States and Iraq in 2003, you had demonstrations everywhere. There was a big signal. It didn't prevent the war to take place. Mm-hmm. The war took place. So you have people in this world conscious of the dangers. But the problem is it's not in our hands. We are, as I said, we have the possibility of knowing and seeing what's happening. And it makes it even more tragic. Anybody in the world can see what's happening anywhere, thanks to television, internet, news, media, and so on. We know whenever a war starts, what happens, we see about massacres. Now, after we have images that might be biased. The images of the wars are always biased as the images of the war in Vietnam. You know, in Vietnam, there has been a moment when the Americans were dominating militarily, but they were losing visually. They were losing the war in the media because of some war photographers who showed terrible images of this war, because some images on television that made that the whole world started to protest, and many people on the American campuses in Washington elsewhere protested against war in Vietnam. So in fact, what's happening? History repeats itself. Now you may ask me, how do I live if I'm such a pessimistic person? I'm going to tell you how do I live. It's not that I'm waiting for the end of the world or the apocalypse. I'm not like these people of the Middle Ages, or, you know, the paintings of Jerome Bosch, yeah, where you have this whole catastrophe, the fire coming. I'm not this kind of guy. I'm not a depressed person. I live very well. I think that whether you are in the Arab world, in Beirut, Damascus, Tangier, or elsewhere, I think that any one of us can have his own contribution to make it better. We cannot change the course of history. We cannot fight against these huge multinational enterprises of global capitalism. We cannot fight against them. But, you know, when I see artists, writers, filmmakers that tell stories that touch me, when I see people in this very polluted country and this very damaged country who go buy a piece of land in the mountain and start an agricultural project, an ecological agricultural project, socially equitable agricultural project, and make olive oil or wine or plant walnuts, I see hope in this. When I see people in this country rehabilitating some old houses to do ecotourism, that's good. These are the initiatives that will save us. I was saying the sens de l'histoire. It's not going to go better. Each one of us, whether he's a banker or an artist or a businessman or a carpet seller or I don't know, any one of us at his own little scale, his own tiny scale, can make things better, you know? Just by being polite with people. In the cities, people are sometimes very aggressive and very nervous. And it's so nice when you are driving to see someone being polite, someone who smiles, someone to say thank you. And this is just little gestures. It starts here. You don't need to have $1 million. You don't need to have Rockefeller besides you. You can start even if you don't have anything. And for me, this is a revolution. I don't see a revolution that will overthrow the big, bad people. I see a little or a multiplicity of little revolutions. You know, Deleuze and Guattari were two French philosophers, wrote a lot about the tiny things, and the tiny things that move, like ants, like insects. Well, it's these tiny, perhaps invisible initiatives that can make the world a little bit better. And at least it's better for us. So if any one of us can do a little initiative like this, well, we can have a better world. I think this is more, much more powerful than going at war against dictators. For me, the guy who is planting olive trees, or for instance, I saw on a TV program a guy in Japan who rediscovered a traditional way of planting rice without any chemical stuff. And he uses ducks. He uses ducks to eat insects. And in fact, he's doing two in one. He has rice and he has ducks. And, well, if others do like him, they will improve the agricultural society situation in Japan or Vietnam or China or all these countries that produce rice. Instead of working with these firms that are selling chemical products that are destroying the environment, well, let them raise ducks. I'm not an agricultural expert. Perhaps it's nothing, but I believe in this kind of initiatives. So you were asking me about what I do as an artist. You saw my pictures about abandoned houses. And I told you it's a war. It's a war. It's a real estate war. I cannot save the buildings. I cannot go. I'm not going to go in front of the bulldozer and do like Jesus Christ and tell them, don't destroy the building, or if you destroy the building, you will kill me. I don't want to be killed to save a building. So I started doing these photos as a catharsis because I was myself suffering of seeing these very violent transformations in my city. You know, facing my home, there was a garden that belonged to the American University of Beirut. A month ago, the university destroyed the garden, and now it's a construction site. It's absolutely immoral. But what do you want me to do? To sue the university? It's their right. It's their land. They can do whatever they want. So by doing this artistic work, I'm trying to give a contribution to the history of this country, to trying to propose a new view on the history, on the memory of this country. Many of the houses in my photos have already disappeared, but at least I can give a contribution, at least I can provide an emotion for people by documenting these houses, by documenting the story of these houses, the story of the people who inhabited these houses, the way people live there, the reason they left from these houses. So it's not the project itself which is important, and my project is not more important than other artists' project in this country, but or elsewhere. But what we are doing as artists is that we take this pitiful situation, this dangerous situation, this sad situation, and we try to communicate some emotion. We try to communicate some beauty. Mm. We try to give, it's not giving hope, but at least giving something positive. Mm. And not be always depressing. Because, you know, when you watch the news in Lebanon or any country in this world, you do a nervous breakdown. It's always negative. It's always bad. News are bad. Things are bad. And it's always bad. So at least you try to have another perspective.
As an artist and as a one who believes in small steps and individual statements, how do these Arab uprisings change your view?
Well, I have seen one work related to the Arab Spring, which is amazing. It's a Lebanese artist named Ali Sherri. He did a video based on images he took from YouTube. And in his video, you have a cosmonaut, a Syrian cosmonaut, who was sent into a special mission with the Soviets in the mid-1980s. And on the video, you see this cosmonaut talking live with Hafez Assad, who was president at this time. Mm. And the conversation is totally surrealistic. The Syrian president greets the Syrian cosmonauts, who is the first, I think, Arab cosmonaut, and I think also the last one, and asks him, what does he see from the space? And the cosmonaut says that he sees the world and he sees Syria, beautiful Syria, the plains of Syria, the villages of Syria, and so on, which is absolutely false, because if you are in the space, I don't think that you have such a precise view to see the details of Syria or any country. So when you see this film, you are tempted either to laugh or to cry. The main plot of the film, you see the Syrian cosmonaut in the spaceship, in the Soviet spaceship, communicating with President of this time, Hafez Assad, and telling him how Syria is beautiful seen from the space. But in parallel, you have other images which are shots from today, or from today when the film was done a year ago. The last images of the film are statues of Hafez al-Assad that are being removed, gigantic statues removed. And they are not removed by the revolutionaries. They are removed by the regime, fearing that the revolutionaries would destroy these statues. And then you see these images, even though Bashar, his son, is still the president of Syria. But when you see the statue being removed, and it is much stronger, probably, because it is enigmatic, then a statue being demolished, as we have seen in Baghdad. Mm. You see, when Saddam fell, all the statues, all the monuments of Saddam Hussein have been removed. And I have a very interesting work by Usama Baalbaki in my book about a man. It's a painting with a man, and you have two feet in bronze fragments of a statue. And I asked Usama Baalbaki if it was Saddam Hussein. He said, who cares if it's Saddam Hussein? It's the idea of a fin de règne, the end of an era. And it's like this famous image I recalled from Theo Angelopoulos, the statue of Lenin going down the Danube on a boat. This Lenin, this reclining Lenin, this huge reclining statue of Lenin, it was the end of the Soviet Empire. And it was a civil war in Yugoslavia. You know, these films, these artistic works, either the film of my colleague Ali Suri or the amazing work of Theo Angelopoulos, who was one of the most brilliant Greek filmmakers, are great reflections on history. And I think this film is much stronger than other films that can be leading us toward a political direction, because finally the film offers us questions. It doesn't offer us answers. And the artist is not here to give lessons. The artist is here to raise the questions. When you see the great artworks of Goya, for instance, or Picasso, the Guernica of Picasso, which is one of the most amazing artworks related to art, politics, history, and war, Picasso is not here to give a solution. Picasso is here to testify about a tragedy that's happening. And the same can be said about Goya, who painted the defenders of Madrid being killed by the French army in the early 19th century. And these artworks are strong because they don't say this is the good and this is the bad and this is how it should be. These artworks are taking history, they are taking the violence of history, and they are providing us a very strong emotion. I know Guernica since I'm young, because Guernica is a very well-known painting. Everybody knows Guernica. But when I first went to Madrid, to the Museo Reina Sofia, and I saw this painting, which is a huge painting, you know what I did? I cried. The painting was done in 1937. The Spanish War has ended a long time ago. I cried because the emotion provided by this painting is still here. It is still intact. And the painting is so strong that it has some kind of a shield. You cannot approach, I couldn't approach. There is a distance of which I could not trespass. I was struck facing this painting. This is what makes Picasso a genius. So in fact, this is the strength of art. Art is based on a historical moment, but it transcends this historical moment. And this is the difference between an artwork and information. This is the difference between a work that will provide you an emotion 10 years later, 100 years later, 200 years later, if we talk about Goya, then TV news bulletin from CNN or BBC, that's just for the moment.
Greg Buchakyan, thank you.
Thank you.
ما كله بسببك انت انت ولا انت شداري لي انا بدي منك اعتذار تمضي